Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to the Global Health Forum on Blog Talk Radio. I'm your host, Dr. Antana Hapte, Chairman of People to People's Board of Directors. This program is brought to you by People to People, an Ethiopian diaspora healthcare organization with no ethnic, religious, or political affiliation. Our objective is to present an engaging and informative discussion on common and important health issues from the perspective of resource-constrained settings. Guests are invited not only for their expertise in the subject matter, but also for their experience and interest in developing countries. The show airs every Thursday at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. You may tune in by using the link provided on the P2P website from your web-enabled device or by dialing 646-595-4742. Press 2 when prompted to listen and press 1 when prompted to speak. You can also email your questions and comments to info@peoplepeople.org or post it on our Facebook page. Our topic for this evening is Ethiopian traditional medicine, a widely practiced phenomenon both by Ethiopians at home and in the diaspora. The practice dates back to the 7th century with variations in different regions of the country. And there's some data to suggest that about 80% of Ethiopians rely on some form of traditional medicine. What has also become increasingly apparent is that traditional medicine is not necessarily the last resort, but the approach of choice in many instances. It is also not an exclusively rural phenomenon, but has migrated to the cities and abroad with the people where medicinal plants are used fairly regularly. Yet the modern practitioner has little to no education or experience with these agents. Joining me this evening to discuss Ethiopian traditional medicine and its nexus with modern medicine are Dr. Fakaru Fulas, a clinical pharmacist and recognized authority in Ethiopian traditional medicine. He has authored 4 books and several scientific articles on the topic. Dr. Fakaru also holds a PhD in pharmacogenosis, which is a study of medicines derived from natural products. He currently serves as a clinical pharmacist at St. Lucy Regional Medical Center in Sioux City, Iowa. So welcome to the show, Dr. Fakaru.
Thank you for having me.
Good evening.
And I have Dr. Busra Tailamatko, who is an associate professor and director of drug information at Howard University in Washington, D.C. He is the principal investigator of the Howard University and Addis Ababa University Twinning Program, and he serves as an external examiner for the pharmacy department of Jimma University. He teaches alternative, complementary, and natural medicine and has written on adverse reactions and interactions between herbal users. And welcome to you, Dr. Bissau.
Thank you so much.
Okay, let me start with you, Dr. Fakaru. If you could give our audience a brief background on Ethiopian traditional medicine, what does it exactly mean? I mean, where does it trace its origin from, and how widely is it practiced?
Well, Ethiopian traditional medicine is a very wide concept. It has different parts to it, and one is the use of medicinal plants and minerals and animal products. And the other aspect is more of psychological aspect of it, which involves using different modalities. And the history of Ethiopian traditional medicine goes back to many thousands of years back. In fact, it dates back to 3,500 years ago. There was a queen of Egypt by the name of Hatshepsut, and she sent an expedition down south to Nubia, which is ancient name of Ethiopia. And that expedition took back a number of medicinal plants, one of which was Hygienia abyssinica, which is Koso, and, you know, other products like cinnamon, myrrh, and incense. So after that, just fast-forwarding to, let's say, about 7th to 11th century, during the Aksumite Kingdom, there were just hundreds of plants used for, you know, various illnesses. And then there was the Zagwe Dynasty, which was around 11th to 13th century. During that time also, there were hundreds of plants used for, you know, for different complaints. And then fast-forwarding to Gondar era, around 17th to the 9th century, there were hundreds of plants used during that time too. And so there is just a long history of use of traditional medicine. And, you know, coming back to the 20th century, you know, different writers wrote different accounts on the use of medicinal plants and traditional medicine. The Polish person by the name of Strelsen comes to mind, and he wrote a series of books in 1955, 66, and 68, just enumerating hundreds of plants and occasionally in traditional medicine. And in 1971, there was a lady by the name Zahibra Hannah Selassie. She wrote a vast account of, you know, medicinal plants used in Ethiopia. And then, of course, you know, recently there were a bunch of reports that came out from Addis Ababa University back in 1976 from a few botanists who used to, you know, collect different plants from different parts of the country. And then in 1989, there was a landmark book which was published by a person called Galahu Nabate, which was a traditional medicine practitioner. And he collaborated with taxonomists at Addis Ababa University, and he produced an impressive 250 medicinal plants in a mimeographed publication. Then in 1993, there was another scientist or botanist by the name David Abella. He produced an impressive book, which was called Medicinal Plants and Enigmatic Health Practices of Northern Ethiopia. And he listed about 250 plants in there. And just recently, at the turn of this millennium, on my own, I had also the privilege of writing four books, trying to kind of look at all the plants from a different perspective, which is, from botany, from pharmacy, and from various aspects. So in a nutshell, that's the long journey of traditional medicine in Ethiopia to the present time, and it has contributed immensely to the development of traditional medicine in the world. One point I need to mention while we are on the subject is there was the first United Nations secretary who happened to visit Ethiopia back in 1946 to 53. And at that time, he was, of course, the secretary of the UN. He was, you know, retired from that position, but he went to Ethiopia to mediate a border conflict between Somalia and Ethiopia, and he became sick, and he was treated by a traditional medicine practitioner, he was relieved. So what he did was went back to his colleagues in the United Nations and convinced some folks there to establish World Health, within the World Health Organization, a traditional medicine, office, kind of spread out after that to, different countries. So Ethiopia had this new contribution towards the development of traditional medicine throughout the world. I think that encapsulates all that as far as the safety of traditional medicine is concerned.
Thank you, Dr. Potato. That's a fascinating synopsis of thousands of years of history in just a few minutes. Let me stay with you for a second. And how that Ethiopian traditional medicine compare with traditional medicine as practiced in the rest of Africa and elsewhere? Are there major similarities and differences?
Well, there are major similarities. The similarities being that they are all anchored in, traditional culture, of course. They are traditionally handed down from generation to generation, and they rely heavily on medicinal plants, interlaced with incantation during administration of those medications. So there is a spiritual side of it, and the physical side of it, as far as, the use of medications. So there is a striking similarity with African countries in that, it was based on mostly oral tradition, and it's widely accepted, about 80%, like you mentioned in the introduction, of the people in Ethiopia's traditional medicine. This percentage holds true also for other African countries, obviously. The unique thing about traditional medicine in Africa is it's not as developed as it is in China because of the influence of colonial rule. As you know, most of Africa was under European colonization. So they don't want indigenous medicine to develop at a faster rate. So so it stayed pretty much not as much developed as it did in countries like China. So the common thread that runs through all countries in Africa is it's not much developed. It's underdeveloped. That's one aspect. Of course, there is an even development depending on which country you are talking about. But overall, you can say it's not advanced. And they use a lot of spiritual healing, which is also common among African countries. And of course, in Ethiopia, you occupy a unique position in Africa due to its geography. It has Middle Eastern influence from the north. There is Arabic influence. So it's an amalgamation of different cultures as far as traditional medicine goes. And so that depending on which region of Africa you go, there is striking similarity. If you go up north, like in Libya and Mauritania, Egypt, Algeria, they share common vegetation. Since they are contiguous in geography and they have similar vegetation types. And if you look at East Africa, like Kenya, Somalia, Ethiopia, Kenya, since they are contiguous, they share common vegetation, and there's also a mix of culture. So the similarity goes with the geographical location of a given African country. So Western African countries also share common vegetation medicinal plants. So, there is variation, but, there's much more commonality than variation within African countries for the reasons I mentioned earlier.
All right, Dr. Basrat, let me bring you to the conversation. And how would you compare Ethiopian traditional medicine with what is described as alternative or complementary medicine in the West?
Thank you, Dr. Antenna. This is a very interesting topic. I was deeply involved listening to Dr. Fakadu's historical perspective in the question you've been asking him. Basically, what we say Ethiopian traditional medicine is kind of similar to what we call it here alternative medicine. Technically, it's the same concept. We call it alternative here because, or complementary medicine here because primarily the Western medicine prescriptions and pharmaceuticals are the primary way to go, especially until the last decade or so. until the traditional medicine starts to really go into the bigger market and people start to go into more into it. So there are a lot of similarities. Traditional medicine and alternative medicine, even though plants are the central key component among the two, all of those, but it includes other things. We will go into it as we discuss more, but in general, we call it the difference, the major difference, I think, with the traditional medicine in general and the Western medicine is the approach is good. It approaches holistically. It approaches a human body as it is, not compartmentalizing like we use in Western medicine, you know, specifically by organ system. But traditional medicine don't do that. They try to include all of them, whether it's Europe, Africa, United States. Some countries are way, way ahead of us than the, some of the Western countries. But so there are a lot of similarities.
All right. So there's a lot of similarities. And then you seem to indicate that there is almost a philosophical difference in approach between traditional medicine and modern medicine, meaning, you know, holistic versus disease-focused, you know, symptom relief versus cure. So that common approach between alternative medicine and even traditional medicine holds true, and there's a philosophical difference between modern medicine and these alternatives?
Yes. You're asking me, right?
Right.
Yes. Some of the countries, for example, way advanced are countries, even in Europe, some countries are way ahead of us, but countries like China, India, they've been practicing herbal medicine for I don't know how many thousands of years. They're well advanced. They train their people. If you're in China, you get a PhD degree, a master's degree to practice traditional medicine. Even in Europe, the most developed countries, Germany was the first one who developed German Commission E that we translated in English. Now it's one of the best reference resources that we use throughout the country. Prevention is a key. The whole body is another approach. As I said, African countries, even though they've been practicing traditional medicine, including Ethiopia, a lot of them are still being practiced the way it has been practiced thousands of years ago. There are some activities, some countries go out and, you know, came up with new policies, including Ethiopia, encouraging the traditional medicine practice. But when it comes to really the science of it, to develop it into a modern system, has not. You know, there is a lot of work to do in that sense. Even though majority of Ethiopians, as Dr. Scott was mentioning, depend on traditional medicine for the day-to-day activities, because it's affordable, it's accessible, they don't have to seek other care professional to do it. But still, it passes from generation to generation, not through a scientific, well-documented way, but through, it's like a secret. It's transferred from family to family, from fathers to sons, and, you know, it stays within the family. So it's not spread out, so they don't seek out the modern way of practicing, incorporating into the traditional medicine to do it the way other countries like Chinese, Indians, or European countries are doing it.
Dr. Fattah, so when we say Ethiopian traditional medicine, are we specifically referring to medicinal plants, herbs, and spices, or is it kind of a catch-all term to include also the non-pharmacological interventions, be it, you know, spiritual or physical manipulations and that kind of intervention?
Well, the use of traditional, I mean, the application of traditional medicine is so wide. It encompasses, various approaches. Of course, you know, the use of medicinal plants accounts for a huge percentage of, traditional medical care. But there are spiritual healers, which go by different names depending on who they are, there are about 7,000 traditional medicine practitioners in Ethiopia, and they go by the name Doctora, which is, which come out of the church, and, they have, a rich knowledge of traditional medicine, and if you look at the Islamic, section of the society, there are traditional healers called Kalicha, who treat patients spiritually, exorcising, evil spirits out of them, which comes on the, psychological, side of treatment. And the Daptaras, or the priests, use incantation, which is dgmts in, the vernacular language. And they use also holy water, and there is amulets they wear around their neck to ward off, evil spirits, which are supposed to be the source of, various, diseases. And it includes, spiritual healing as well as the application of medicinal plants. Of course, there is almost about, 10,000 plant species in Ethiopia, all in all, and about 1,000 of them are used for various medicinal purposes, you can find them in open markets, in big towns, or in rural areas. You find them in, periodic markets. They are widely sold. And I just looked at recent statistics that came out. It's just so amazing that about 75% of Addis Ababans use traditional medicine in addition to conventional medicine, which is quite striking. There aren't any, other reports available, but back in the 1980s, I believe Dr. Jamal Abdelkader looked at, many, many patients at the Black Lion Hospital and at St. Paul's Hospital in Addis Ababa. And he found out many of the patients he saw used the traditional medicine. And there was a recent study that came out, not recent, back in 1992, of course, depending on how recent you want to be. There was a study that looked at 113 patients, and they found out 27% of those patients came from rural areas. Of course, they used traditional medicine. And 12% came from urban areas, and they used traditional medicine. So quite a large number of, including in towns and in big cities, use traditional medicine, which again comprises of using medicinal plants in addition to just spiritual healing. So it's kind of widespread, but but traditional medicine is kind of broad, but, mostly when people think of traditional medicine, of course, they think of plants, whether they are thinking of a bone setter, Wagesha, usually during their, healing, they use plants before they puts either a dislocated bone into its natural place because they have to take care of the pain, they have to kind of change the malleability of the bone to a certain extent. So they use different products like Amish, for instance. They use for, pain control to put back dislocated bone. And, of course, there is just, a host of other medications they use for different purposes. But yeah, whether it's herbalists or you know, doctoras or you know, or other spiritual leaders, they all come under the domain of traditional medicine. But quite a good part of them use medicinal plants to, you know, alleviate pain or suffering, whatever the etiology of you know, that problem is.
So the recent studies did not show any significant difference in use between rural and urban. Is that what I'm?
Well, actually, if you look at the national statistic, you know, well, there's always that national statistic everybody mentions. I don't think there's ever been a national survey which is conducted, but you know, most of the people in Ethiopia live in the rural areas, so they don't have access to, you know, modern healthcare facilities. So it's logical to think about 80% of them use traditional medicine. You know, there have been some samples, you know, taken from different localities in the country. So they are consistent. You know, they show 80% of the rural population use traditional medicine, which is obvious, you know. But I think what I pointed out earlier, that 25% of Addis Ababa use traditional medicine is just to drive home the point that even though they have access to, you know, modern healthcare facilities, they would still treat, you know, minor complaints with, you know, medicinal plants grown in the back, you know, in the backyard, or they go out to, you know, local markets and, you know, buy some medications, you know, some, you know, herbal products. Just to give you an example, you know, when I was growing up, I remember we never used, you know, modern homicidal agents, you know, for, you know, typical infestation. So what people used to do was, while I was growing up, you know, we used to use COSO, which is Hygienia abyssinica, which is easy to treat. If you dose it right, of course, you know, you can get rid of the worm very easily. Like Dengatanya too, which is, you know, manifestation of, which is manifested in pain, fever, and that kind of stuff. You know, people would be administered Dengatanya to treat, you know, that kind of complaint. And eucalyptus, which is known to have eucalyptol oil in it, which has a decongestant effect. So whenever people are, you know, inflicted with, you know, cough symptoms, they usually, you know, just boil the leaf and inhale the vapor, which, you know, which is straightforward. So I think probably that 75% statistic I mentioned may be exaggerated. I don't know how it was synthesized as a percentage, but, you know, but someone can surmise from, you know, those minor complaints that, you know, people, you know, with traditional medicine, even in towns, but, you know, the majority of any other alternative. But to use traditional medicine, I'm talking about, you know, people in the rural areas. There isn't any large study which has been done nationally to ascertain that 80%, but if you look into any literature, you'll come across that percentage, you know, repeatedly mentioned, that it could be up or down. But I think it arose out of the fact that, you know, most Ethiopians live in the rural areas. Of course, as urbanization, you know, grows, as urbanization becomes intense, I think that percentage might go down and people would return to modern healthcare facilities, especially for complications that are insidious, you know, that, you know, people don't see very easily, like, you know, if they have heart problems or lung problems or, you know, something that they couldn't see. But if they are asymptomatic and, you know, they use, you know, traditional medicine. But even for some complaints, you know, which, you know, they define as diabetes, hypertension, and that kind of stuff, you know, they still use to a certain extent, certain you know, traditional herbs, you know, to treat that.
Yeah, what I find fascinating is, unlike what is being commonly assumed, that you know, even traditional medicine, you know, in the modern era, is used only as a last resort, or only by people who do not have access to modern medicine. You know, that myth has been dispelled. It is an approach of choice in many instances, as you just described, even in the urban areas. It would be interesting to know if there's any statistics or study that pertains to Ethiopians in the diaspora. How widely is it used in the population outside of the home country?
You want me to address that for Dr. Besatz?
Yeah, go ahead, Dr. Besatz.
Well, yeah, I'm not aware of any study. Probably Dr. Besatz might know, but I haven't read any study that came out in any publication that shows the extent of traditional medicine used by the Ethiopian diaspora. And I think the only account that I came across was while reading way back some literature. I have that some Ethiopian Jews in Israel, in southern Israel, I think the town is called Beersheba. So there is a community of Ethiopians there who use traditional medicine, you know, when they feel that, they are sick. You know, they call it Dhamma Koshesh, which means, if they feel that their blood is infected or has some unexplainable reason, they use bloodletting, which is, which had its roots, of course, in Europe, back in the days before modern medicine came. That's one of the ways they used to treat, different ailments, by letting out blood, out of the body. They think the noxious stuff, that causes disease, might be treated that way. And I think that's the only account I came across in southern Israel. Some Ethiopian Jews use traditional medicine in that way. But I can only speculate that, I think what we call dietary supplements in the States, here in the United States, is equivalent to traditional medicine. Even though those products are not brought over from Ethiopia, they are sold here in supermarkets, in nutritional stores, and different outlets, even on the internet. Put out a bunch of dietary supplements. So I don't know if those can be viewed as traditional medicine, and then extrapolate from the United States statistics. I think 40% of Americans use alternative traditional medicine, according to a report that was published in the 1990s by a physician named Eisenberg. And but as far as Ethiopians are concerned, nobody has taken that community and done any survey, what extent they use traditional medicine. I'm not aware of any. I don't know. Doctors may talk about that more. I'm not sure.
Yeah, Dr. Kadu suggested study in the Jewish immigrant population. Other than that, I don't think there is any major study, but living in Washington, D.C., and going through so many Ethiopian stores, traditional stores, almost all of them are packed with some kind of spices or herbal product imported from Ethiopia. So a lot of immigrants, just a personal, I don't think we, you know, nobody did a study really to see the impact. But a lot of Ethiopians, they use traditional medicine, not the one, even though it's the same garlic, it's the same ginger, and the same flaxseed, and so on, they still prefer to go to those Ethiopian stores, convenience stores, and buy those that are imported directly from Ethiopia. I did a small study a while ago with my students. We did a survey to see the safety of herbal products. Because whenever we think of traditional medicine or herbal products, the way it's marketed is, you know, traditional, you know, it's natural, so it must be safe. So we just wanted to know if it's really safe, as they say. So we went out. They're not all Ethiopians, but majority of them are immigrants from Africa. So we set up a table, and we give out $5 coupons, which we use to buy any product they want in the store. And we gave them a one-page survey product. And they did survey. It's a small study. It's less than 200 people, about 180 people we surveyed. We found out, it's very interesting, about 19%, which means almost one out of five, they said they experienced some kind of adverse effect as a result of taking herbal medicine. And 4% say they ended up in emergency room. So, but when it comes to Ethiopian traditional medicine, we use all these spices, and all of this traditional medicine are also part of the food that we normally eat. We use them as spices because we use them in a small quantity. We get the benefit without getting the toxicity. So it's the same tradition here. We use the same spices, the same additives when we cook, when our, you know, our sisters, wives, when they cook, we cook. We do those spices, but there is not such a large study, the impact, to determine how widely it is used to spread, except those you know, minor things that we see on a daily basis.
That's very interesting. And I've seen the same statistics for the United States where nearly 40% are reported as using alternative or complementary medicine. But they include approaches that, you know, diet, exercise, behavioral, I mean, non-pharmacological interventions, about, you know, 40% of them. So that's really is like in the same ballpark as we're talking about the urban use of Ethiopian traditional medicine. Well, I want to remind our audience that you're listening to the Global Health Forum on Blog Talk Radio. My guests this evening are Dr. Bagadu Fulas and Dr. Busrat Hailambeskar. And we'll open up the phones now and take some questions from the audience. We're discussing Ethiopian traditional medicine. But I want to remind you to mute your radio when calling in, since the sound on the phone and the radio will be out of sync. You can also email us through info@people.org or post your questions on our Facebook page. I can start out with an email from Isai from Toronto, Canada. It's rather lengthy, but let me see if I can summarize it. It says, my mother has been living with me for 2 years now because of her ill health and her need for close medical follow-up. On my last count, she was taking 14 different medicines. She's also taking all sorts of herbs and concoctions she gets from Ethiopia. I tell the doctor every visit about this, but she does not pay much attention. Are there some commonly used medicinal plants which are especially notorious in interacting with commonly prescribed modern medicine? And it says, my mother is on a blood thinner among other things. Either of you can take a stab at this one.
Okay, so the question is about maybe interacting with other medications?
Right, that is what it is. He's not specified what traditional medicine she's taking, but she's taking quite a few medicines, and including
anticoagulants. Right. Well, there's a good news and a bad news. The bad news is that patients don't talk to their doctors about any of the traditional medicine, and doctors don't ask. They don't ask because they don't think it's important to ask, or if they ask and the patient tells them the type of herbs they're taking, maybe the knowledge is not there. Traditional medicine, even a country like Ethiopia or other African countries where over 80% are dependent on it, the modern medicine, the modern training, medical school, pharmacy school, nursing school, any of allied health, this traditional medicine training is not part of it. I can tell you what we learned in pharmacy school. We did learn pharmacognosy, but it has nothing to do with how the drug is used to cure illness or for prevention or anything related to a patient care. We learn pharmacognosy to how to extract the plant, how to dry it, how to create a concussion, how to store it, but there's no education as far as when it comes to the patient, how do we counsel the patient, or whether that medication, that whatever herb is, how safe it is, how useful it is, or whether it's interacting with it, and so on and so on. So that wasn't at the time when we were in school. It wasn't a training program. It was not part of the training. So yes, when pharmacists, when they get trained, they know about the herbs, but not in relation to patients. When you come to nursing and medical school or any allied health school, that's not even there. So none of them were trained in that sense. It's not just Ethiopia. Even in the United States, a lot of Western countries, traditional medicine are not part of it. Even in the United States, I mean, you know what we know. People don't ask, and, the patients don't tell. In a pharmacy setting, most pharmacists I talk to, they say they actually get educated by patients coming to the pharmacy to buy an herb, teaching the pharmacist in that way. So even if there are a lot of drug interaction and drug lab interaction, drug disease interaction, drug herb interaction, all kind of interaction, it wasn't reported because nobody knew that there was an interaction. It wasn't identified in the first place. The second thing is the good news is most of these herbs are used, as I said, in a small quantity, and when they are taken as a whole, even though one, two ingredients out of the whole might be the one that actually causes or heals or prevents, because it's taken as a whole, its impact is small enough, it may not cause major damage. But when you come to Ethiopia, everything, including the spices like garlic or ginger, the one that normally we use with, hot tea, with food, if you take it too much, it causes berberi, karafa, Gatenya, Avish, all of this interfere either with hypertensive medication or anticoagulant medication or maybe anti-seizure medication, but we don't take a high enough quantity to really make a big significant difference. But if we take them, then definitely there will be drug interaction. I think the discussion has to be initiated, stimulated, or has to be started in all healthcare professionals, especially in the countries where the majority of people are dependent on herbs, not because only they believe it, because maybe a lack of access, lack of resources, or just because of that's a tradition that everybody, everybody advised to. It has to be one of the discussion. I think we came to a point now. Traditional medicines are not to be left alone independently as a separate entity. It has to be part of the integral system. Even though the policies are there, but the research is not there, the toxins are not there. And Ethiopian medicine, overall, is dependent purely on a Western-based type training. So traditional medicine are not even part of it. Even, as I say, even countries like United States are just picking it up. The public is way, way ahead of the healthcare professionals. But we have to start thinking about it. Once we know, then more and more people are aware of it. I'm sure a lot of adverse reactions, drug interactions, unwanted effects and complaints will show up. Even these days, patients have complained. They don't come tell the doctor what happened because they know it's related to their traditional medicine. So the database, MedWatch, or those medication errors, adverse reaction reporting systems through the FDA, or even back in Ethiopia with DACA, the old name, there were no reports. People are not coming forward to report all of those, so it's very hard to identify and pinpoint the real impact.
That's very true. I mean, even here in the United States, in our practice, we see more and more patients are using herbal medicine as either as supplements or as symptom management, and it's getting to the stage where it can no longer be ignored, and the conversation has to be encouraged. And there is a steep learning curve even for the medical profession as far as what herbal medicine are used and how they interact with the conventional medicine. Having said that, are there any widely used medicinal plants which are especially notorious in the sense that they interact with commonly prescribed medications, or they have a very narrow therapeutic window that they tend to be toxic? Is there any cautionary tale that we can share with our audience?
Yeah, me to address that?
No, go ahead.
Well, just to piggyback on what Dr. Vissera mentioned, always the rule of thumb is don't take so many herbal products which are put together, because drug, medicinal plant interaction is a function of the number of medicinal plants, which are found in a certain preparation. So the more number of plants that are concocted into one preparation, the higher the likelihood of interactions is. I can give you just a whole range of examples that interact with modern medications. Like people, garlic is so benign. People think garlic is safe and they take it for diabetes and hypertension in Ethiopia traditionally. But, so many people are infected with, HIV. Yeah, so they are on antiretrovirals. And so garlic interacts with HIV medications, so they have to be closely monitored. The dose should be adjusted. And so that's a clear example. Garlic is widely used, and, there's widespread, HIV prevalence in Ethiopia. So if people take garlic, the dose of the antiretrovirals should be adjusted. And if you take, let's say, castor oil, castor oil, people take it for, as a laxative. But if they are on anti-nausea medications like domperidol, which is, used. And, they could end up with cardiac complication called torsades, which, is, a very, notorious, arrhythmic, dysrhythmic, episode. And, if you take aloes, which is rates, potassium goes down, which, which leads to, cardiac toxicity. If somebody choose cats or chats, for either for medicinal purposes or, to stay awake or for euphoria. People take antibiotics, right? So for different, complications, for different types of infections. Like amoxicillin and ampicillin, their absorption goes down, so that also have to be adjusted. If you take cinnamon, cinnamon is very common, it's part of you know, our spice, but it could be also taken for medicinal purposes. It binds with tetracycline, so it affects, you know, the bioavailability. If you look at romaine, which is pomegranate, you know, it has a bunch of tannins in it, and it binds a lot of oral medicine. Fennel or encelad, you know, is taken for cough and headache. So people would have to avoid what, you know, antibiotics called quinolones because it binds to these medications. So there is a whole host of, you know, we're talking about, you know, blood thinners, you know, pumpkin, you know, dumba, is taken for cough in Ethiopia or even, you know, for just the pleasure of it. So what it does is it increases INR, which means, you know, blood stays thin for a prolonged time. So if somebody is on warfarin, which is, you know, anticoagulant, the dose has to be adjusted because pumpkin has the tendency to thin blood. So you have to, you know, jack up or decrease the warfarin that you use and so on and so forth. So if you combine a bunch of, you know, traditional medicine, I think, you know, the Chinese, you know, are known for using multi-component medicinal products. And if somebody is on conventional medication for whatever complaint, you know, they are prescribed for, the chance of drug herbal medication interaction is quite, quite high. So I think the bottom line would be to tell their primary care physicians if they take, and they shouldn't just ignore whatever they take is benign, it's natural, so it wouldn't affect, you know, as the medications have been taken, you know, that shouldn't be the thinking. They should always disclose what, you know, they have been on when they see their physician at their clinic. And of course, you know, like Dr. Muslat mentioned, there is just a wide, wide, wide knowledge gap as far as, you know, dietary supplements or herbs, you know, on the part of the either physicians, even among pharmacists, you know. I mean, there isn't really wide, the broad knowledge. Even though, you know, some, you know, pharmacists, you know, read on their own and try to screen some, you know, drug-herb interactions, you know, still there is that knowledge gap or communication gap. So, yeah, I mean, you know, all those medications, all those herbs that I mentioned are prone to really cause sometimes catastrophic, you know, interactions. So everybody should be aware, you know, the patients, the primary care physician, their pharmacists, everybody should be in a team to address that kind of problem.
I guess, if you allow me, just let me add one
sure.
comment. Because like Afkadu, he really covered quite a bit of them. But let me say one thing. Talba, which is flax seed, I was fortunate to go to Ethiopia when one of the masters in clinical pharmacology graduates presented his thesis, and it was on flax seed. And he did a research on, I forgot the individual name, it's about 3-4 years ago. He did an experiment on rats using talba, comparing with omeprazole, which is a proton pump inhibitor, one of the most very effective acid, you know, blocking agent. And he used the hydrochloric acid to burn the GI lining mucosa of this rats, and he found out that the healing rate and the extent of healing was statistically insignificant between talba and omeprazole. It was very fascinating
wow.
to hear that. Every time I have stomach upset, all I do is I have those talba, powdered talba, I mix it with water. I mean, in no time, it's like one of the most wonderful antacids. I'm a witness myself. But at the same time, flaxseed also decreases platelet aggregation. It increases the effect of lipid-lowering agents, so it is a hypoglycemic agent. Yeah. It contains some phytoestrogens, so it has some hormonal effect. People with breast cancer or hormonal sensitive issues. It also enhances the laxative effect because it's like a stool softener by itself. If we combine it with other laxatives, it may lead to loss of electrolytes. So I guess what it is that herbal products have to be treated the way the concept about modern medicine. In modern medicine, we take them because there is a benefit, but they also have side effect drug interaction. The same concept has to apply to the traditional medicine. We take them because they have benefit, but they just because they are we get them from naturally, they're not safe. They also have their own side effects, their own toxicity. It's a matter of knowing in more depth, putting more resources into research, but they should be part of the Western medicine as long as we know their shortcomings and strengths.
All right. Let me take one call from area code 510. Go ahead. You're on the line.
Hi. Good evening. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you very well.
Okay. Hi. I'm one of the people that enjoy your show, and my question is about this herb that is quite popular in Ethiopia and in some parts of the world these days. It's called different names, Moringa, and it's called Shefarau in Ethiopia. It's some kind of green herb powder that is widely available these days, and it's being used by many people nowadays, and I wanted to know what the scientific ingredients are and the dosage for it. It doesn't come with any instructions. It comes in a pack, and you don't know if you're to take a spoonful or whatever amount you're supposed to take. So if any of you guys can comment on what the benefits are, I would appreciate it.
Thank you. Who wants to take this one?
I don't know if Dr. Fukadu knows about it. I heard so much about Moringa. I was in Ethiopia not too long ago, and I even attempted to buy it from the market to see the depth of it. The issue with some of these plants and some of this herbal thing is that I've done a big study with another herb that was very popular about 4 or 5 years ago. It's only testimonial. People come out and they give testimonies. But actually, when you go through literature search to see if there are any clinical studies, you couldn't find anything. So it's just word of mouth. I forgot the herb that I did search about 4 or 5 years ago. It was noni juice. It was very, very popular. I don't know if you heard of it before. But later on, after it becomes so popular, after the company makes so millions of money, we found out that it contains a small amount of non-steroidal. So it takes away your pain, it takes away your inflammation. But technically, that's all you can get out of it. I haven't done any research. I haven't seen. I tried to search one time. There's no publication in it. The company who is producing it does not give you information intentionally, because if they have literature supporting their claim, it should be out. There should be somewhere in the literature. Somebody has to publish it. Somebody has to do the study. But. Anybody, it seems like I haven't gone out of Addis, but in Addis, everybody is familiar with it. So I have to educate about it.
All right, maybe you can encourage one of your students next time around to do some work on this, because it's really fascinating to have an evidence basis double blind study. And it's just fascinating what you said about Taliban PPIs, that they it's not just anecdotal, but somebody took the time to do a study on them. And I think that would be the way forward for traditional medicine. So before we wrap up here, that was one of the questions I wanted to ask was, what do you see on the horizon for Ethiopian traditional medicine? What should be the future focus and direction of research? So if you can both comment on this briefly.
Okay. I think I'll start. It has a huge, huge, huge potential. That's what I think. But there should be a good collaborative effort involving different disciplines. It should involve taxonomists, traditional medicine practitioners, chemists, pharmacologists, clinicians, and formulation experts. What had happened in the past was like a taxonomist goes out and collects a medicinal plant, he identifies the species and collects herbarium specimen, stores it, is forgotten. And the chemist would look at medicinal plant, try to isolate the medicinal components, and it ends there. It's a dead end. Or somebody, let's say somebody doing ethnomedicine, would go out and record a certain community in a certain part of Ethiopia uses this medication for this purpose. It ends there. But if all these disciplines come together, like chemistry and taxonomy and pharmacy, medicine. So if it is multidiscipline collaborative effort, I'm sure there's a lot of potential that needs to be tapped into and brought out, and it could really be on a path with modern medications. So I think the driving point is collaborative research. Anywhere you go, even in this country, whenever they do research, it's not only the chemist doing their chemistry work, but they collaborate with clinicians. They collaborate. I mean, if you look back the history of Taxol, the history of BP16, the history of all those big blockbusters, they didn't come out of a chemistry lab only, but they have to. You have to have different collaboration at different levels from different scientists. So the same applies in Ethiopia.
Yes, just to, do we have another minute or so?
Yeah, go ahead, Dr.
Okay, just to comment, to add what Dr. Fakadi said, herbal product traditional medicine are very, very difficult really to regulate, to monitor, et cetera, et cetera. Even the one, the caller that we have about Moringa, it's used for arthritis, joint pain, asthma, cancer, constipation, diabetes, and so on and so on. The list is so huge. If you see every herb you see, the application is, the list is so huge. You don't know where to start, where to stop, where to end. That is what complicates. It may be true. Maybe that herb may be used for multiple diseases, but you can tell that it's not a wonder drug that affects every single organ. It's just that modern thinking is not supporting that one herb like Moringa affects almost every single organ in your body system. It's very difficult to do it. But other countries have done way, way better work. China, the Chinese people are well advanced in this, the Indian people and other countries. So I think people like, developing countries like Ethiopia or any African country, I think we should learn how they did it and use their system in order to apply to our own local endemic plants in order to modernize them and to bring them to the market. People are using it anyway, regardless whether we follow, we study them or not. People are dependent on it. So why not take the initiative to bring it to the market using the system that's already been there, used by other countries? I think that's the way to go.
All right, we're coming to the end of the show. A fascinating conversation. Hopefully we'll come back to this conversation at a later time. And I think what is so fascinating about traditional medicine and its approach is that it does have the conceptual framework to address multidimensional issues, unlike conventional medicine, and that it addresses not only the physical but also spiritual, social, and human dimensions of the disease, and it treats the person as a whole and not as a body part. So it is going to be something that modern medicine will have to contend with and have a passionate way how they can coexist. I would like to thank my guests, Dr. Fagadu and Dr. Bustrat, both for sharing their expertise with our audience today and their tremendous contribution in the field of Ethiopian traditional medicine. Ethiopian traditional medicine is both a national treasure and a stark reminder of our proud heritage, and it really bolsters our claim as the cradle of civilization. The potential as a credible alternative and or complementary to modern medicine is real. It's exciting to know about the work that's being done to make it to conform to the scientific rigor in establishing efficacy, safety, availability, etc. Dr. Fakhar Pulas is a clinical pharmacist, a researcher in Ethiopian traditional medicine, and the author of several books and articles on the topic. He plans a book tour in Washington, D.C. soon, where interested people will have a chance to meet him personally and discuss his work. We'll be announcing the date and venue on the P2P website as soon as it becomes available. Thank you for being part of our show this evening, Dr. Fakhar.
Thank you.
And Dr. Bustrat Haile-Mesker is an associate professor and director of drug information at Howard University in Washington, D.C. He is also the principal investigator of the Howard University and Anchorage University training program. He's helped set up the clinical pharmacy program in Addis Ababa and works in integrating alternative, complementary, natural medicine with modern medicine. Thank you, Dr. Bustrat, for sharing your perspective with me.
Thank you, Dr. Anten. I appreciate that.
And thank you all for tuning in, and mark your calendar for more informative shows on People-to-People's Global Health Forum every Thursday, 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Our lineup for the rest of the month, next Thursday, February 13th, Global Health Forum will be featuring Dr. Steven Friedberg, Professor Emeritus of Neurosurgery. We'll be discussing the neurosurgery training program in Ethiopia, the challenges and opportunities going forward, and the role of transfer partnership in medical education among other themes. This show will be moderated by Dr. Abel Haragoin and Yabi Marcos. And on February 20th, Dr. Lydia Kutzwa will be hosting Dr. Talao Milma, Professor of Immunology and Virology at UC Davis, renowned scientist with work on vaccines and zoonotic infections. This show will be airing at a special time of 10 p.m. instead of the usual 9 p.m. with market calendars. And at the end of the month, February 27th, the fourth Thursday of every month, we'll have special presentations on mental health issues called Tabu No More. It's a collaborative effort with One World Communication, and this segment is being hosted by Dr. Jeffrey Hoffman, clinical psychologist and CEO of Kenya International. We'll be discussing youth challenges in the diaspora population with his guests. You can help shape our lineup for next month by submitting your comments and suggestions through info@peopletopeople.org or People to People's Facebook page. And remember, if you're unable to tune in live, you can access the archived show using the link on our website. I'm Dr. Antana Hafte, Chairman of People to People's Board of Directors, and I'll be back with you the first Thursday of March with another segment of the Global Health Forum. Thank you for your support and stay engaged.